BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and coming up in the next hour, my guests and I will be looking at Bristol's housing, social housing in particular, and how some in the city are preparing for a life without money. Our economics correspondent Martin Summers is here to give his perspective on, amongst other things, how the slump is affecting whether or not we can keep a roof over our head. Overall, we spend more on our rent and our mortgage than anything else, so how will dwindling incomes and job losses affect housing? Our reporter Quentin Masseron reports on the French workers' tactic of boss napping. And to wrap up the show, Colin Powers here to tell us about his attempts as a layman to navigate his way through Britain's legal system. We'll also be dropping in on one of Bristol's first ever free shops in Stokes Croft. But before that, here is the long-range weather forecast for the next two weekends from metcheck.com. This coming weekend, temperatures will be about 14 degrees on Saturday and 12, a little bit colder on Sunday. Clouding over both days, but faster on Sunday. Next week is generally mild, so it's warming up a little, cloudy and rain on and off all week. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of May, will be warm, around about 17 degrees Celsius, warmer than this weekend, and more cloudy but rain-free. Week after next will be colder again, quite a lot of rain early in the week. And that was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. I'm joined now by ex-New Economics Foundation researcher and Bristol Debt Advice Centre researcher Martin Summers to give us a bit of a community view of some of the points in this week's news. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Now, first of all, a little something about the swine flu. It was interesting because last week we were discussing emergency planning and emergency management. We had Kelvin Hattersley on from the Bristol City Council Emergency Planning Department. And then the next day, literally, this swine flu epidemic has, supposed epidemic has hit. So have you got any insight into that at all?
Well, obviously, I'm not an epidemiologist or whatever the word is. So I haven't got any technical things to say about the flu itself, although I do note that that there is talk of the Mexican economy being affected, and obviously the potential economic effects of this are potentially huge.
Well, we've heard that flights have been cancelled, and also that there's been lots more of this Tamiflu virus, whatever it is, the Tamiflu pill ordered. But that's actually connected to Donald Rumsfeld, you were saying.
It is, yes. I mean, Tamiflu was originally developed as a response to the so-called avian flu scare of a couple of years ago. And of course, the problem we've got with the production of all kinds of antiviral drugs and drugs in general is that it's dominated by private sector firms who are determined to protect their patents. And in fact, you know, this is actually very, very antisocial. When developing countries try to develop generic drugs at a cheaper cost to deal with things like malaria and AIDS and so on, these big companies wade in and don't let them do it. And, you know, there's a very strong case for the socialisation of production of drugs.
So there's certainly some vested interests hanging around in the background.
Indeed. I mean, it's an ill wind that blows nobody to good. And the owners of Tamiflu, including Donald Rumsfeld, are set fair to make a great deal of money at the taxpayers' expense here.
Anyway, back on to economic matters and the sort of general slump. Whether we want to call it a slump or a credit crunch, to what extent, Martin, is it something which is really happening in Europe and the United States, and to what extent is it actually happening also in China, Russia, and Japan? Because we're told that this is a big global phenomenon.
Well, I mean, if you think back to 18 months ago, all of the talk was that China in particular and possibly India would carry on growing strongly and would then provide the necessary demand in the world economy to keep it from shrinking. It's quite clear that that's not the case, that both economies are absolutely integrated into the globalised world economy and that they are both suffering. They've still got positive economic growth in both countries, but it's slowing down dramatically and unemployment is rising in both of those countries. So the real paradox, of course, is that the stock market has been bouncing. And this is what leads some people to say that the green shoots of recovery have reappeared. I mean, my own view of that is if you chuck billions of dollars of taxpayers' money at the banks, then of course the stock market's going to bounce a bit. But the real economy has continued to crash pretty drastically. Unemployment's still rising. GM and Chrysler have both gone bust in the last week. I mean, the real economy is still in dire straits.
Okay, on to the domestic political front, and the Guardian's, of course, is a Labour paper, a socialist paper, paper.
Left, I'd say.
Well, all right, left paper. Their political editor Michael White's been saying the last couple of days that Gordon Brown's lost it and he's passed a tipping point.
Well, I mean, people might say that. I think he's a rather tragic character. Because in his youth, he used to have some quite strong ideas about the economy, which he jettisoned in his middle age, and he's now been associated very strongly with deregulation, with pushing the City of London, and all the rest of it.
But didn't most Labour?
This has all gone sour on him.
But didn't most Labour people, like Tony Blair, for example, he was in CND in his youth, and didn't most of the Labour leadership, you know, sort of were a bit more radical when they were younger. That's easy to be radical when you're young.
One understands that there is, you know, that things change over time and that people's views moderate and so on. But to get it so drastically wrong has been a big disaster for the Labour Party. The City of London has had enormous power in this country since the Big Bang in the 80s, which was brought in under Margaret Thatcher. The Labour Party made a kind of decision that they were going to go along with all of that, and that was the basis of their pact with the devil, really, that they, as long as the City of London seemed to know what it was doing, Labour got re-elected, they were happy enough. But of course they should have been on the case of the City a long time ago. Brian Gould, who was Neil Kinnock's right-hand man, left this country and went back to be an academic in New Zealand in the 80s, at the point at which the Labour leadership decided that they were going to make their peace with the City, because he said that's not the role of the Labour leadership. The Labour leadership are there to bring this, cut the City down to size. And I think we're now reaping the whirlwind of this whole permissive attitude towards high finance has now backfired spectacularly.
So do you think that the Labour Party will have somebody else to take it into the next general election, which is probably going to be next May or June sometime? And if so, is it going to be to the left or to the right? Or what kind of candidate might it be if it's not Gordon Brown?
I think the problem is that there is no clear alternative candidate and the party as a whole is not sure which way to go. You've still got disgruntled Blairites who think that Brown's too far to the left, although what planet they are on I really don't know. The problem is that it's very difficult to find anybody who's got a serious track record of standing up to big finance. Maybe it'll be somebody. I mean, nobody had heard of Barack Obama 3 years before he became president. And I think that's not just in the Labour Party, but in all of the political parties, we may see a process whereby the old guard, who are associated with all of these discredited policies, are removed, and a new guard comes forward who probably people haven't heard of yet.
Right, Martin, thanks. We'll be hearing a bit more from you later on housing. But we start looking at housing this week by going out onto the streets of Bristol, and Quentin Masseron has been out there asking you what your views are on the current housing situation and whether you think that there is a housing crisis.
No, build more, I guess. Funding those people that don't have enough money, or help them just to get an education, or help them. I don't know, really. I think it's a bit of a vicious circle. There are people that don't have enough money for houses because they don't have an education. So I think that's where you need to target people before they get into that problem. They need to, you know, kind of get set up.
Do you think there are a solution for housing crisis?
Well, there is if they use what they've got but lower the rent. Now, things are too expensive for people. It's all bureaucracy, and they're not. There's too many civil servants doing the wrong job. Mm-hmm. What can you do? First and foremost, they must do is to sort out the landlord situation. Whereas every landlord, I think there's new registration coming in for those. They must be licensed, and they must make sure that the properties that are let are in very, very good condition, not some of the slums that they just take money off and they couldn't care less whether or not they're standard. That's the first thing they ought to do. Then, of course, Bristol City, like any other city, like Cardiff or wherever, they've got to put out a special housing department that can actually build houses properly, or lets or flats, and have them properly policed so as everybody gets a fair chance.
Yeah, I think they could like rent out all private properties so people can rent properties to stay in.
Use the empty houses.
The empty houses?
Yeah, there's loads of empty houses.
Where?
All over the place. Ask the council, they know all about them. There are lots of empty properties in Bristol, and the council are trying to get people to bring them back into usefulness. So, I don't know. But there are lots of empty houses to use.
Yeah, particularly in this sort of credit crunch situation, where also, if you look at the backdrop of Tory housing policy, a lot of council housing has been sold off to private individuals, people have made profits from it, and there's a much smaller amount of housing available for people that need it.
I think there is a housing crisis in England generally, yes. They need to build more houses, and they need to stop bringing in people from outside, using up the houses we've already got, to be honest.
My son needs a house. His marriage has broken up, and at the moment he's got nowhere to stay. He's just kipping on the floor in the front room.
Well, keeping a roof over our head is getting more difficult as the financial disaster kicks in. There's also a subtle psychological effect which hits our stress levels and can often increase tensions between housemates and in the family. Simon Nunn is based in the Seed Centre in St Paul's, and he's the South of England representative on the National Housing Federation, which oversees the management of a lot of Bristol's and Britain's social housing.
I'm Simon Nunn. I'm head of the South Region for the National Housing Federation, which is effectively the trade body that represents housing associations.
Well, what with the financial catastrophe or credit crunch or whatever you want to call it, a lot of people are concerned that they may not be able to pay their rent, or they may not be able to find adequate housing. This is a big worry for people. So has the Federation been looking at this problem?
Absolutely. I mean, we've been saying for a long time, even before the credit crunch happened, that there's a massive shortage of supply of social and affordable housing. The good news is that the government has finally brought forward investment into social housing. The bad news is this is only going to last for a brief period of time, because clearly with the current economic situation, investment in public services and subsidies for social housing are probably going to be cut, just like every other public service.
Well, we were discussing this last week, and it's almost as if the banks have run off with the money just when society needs it.
Well, you could put it like that, Tony. The other issue, of course, in relation to the banks and the lenders that's affecting people across the southwest and right across the country is the fact that some people seem to think that the collapse in house prices is solving the affordability problem, but it isn't, because people can't get mortgages. And we have the ridiculous situation. By 2007, house prices were so overinflated that we'd have to see a fall in house prices of something like over 70% to get back to sort of normal affordability definitions.
Now, the government quango, I guess it is, that supports social housing is the Housing Corporation, and that's just literally over the winter time been abolished and replaced with something else. Can you just take us through that? How has that, and what changes has that brought?
Well, in technical terms, the Housing Corporation was the body that not only regulated housing associations, it also provided the finance, the grant funding to enable housing associations to build new affordable homes. What's happened is that the regulatory side, the inspection side that inspects the services, makes sure a good service is being provided, has been separated from the funding side, and that funding side is called the Homes and Communities Agency. And we welcome the creation of the Homes and Communities Agency. The communities word, isn't it, is an important word. You know, we hope that they do focus on building communities and building neighbourhoods and bring that investment forward while they can.
So what are the early signs to this new regime?
Well, we've had a really positive experience of the Homes and Communities Agency. We work well with Colin Moulton, who's the head in the South West, the regional director in the South West. They've shown themselves to be flexible in terms of recognising that the amount of grant rate or subsidy going into social housing projects needs to be increased. They recognise that we need to find more public land, cheap land, to allow affordable housing to be developed. And they also recognise that we're going to have to do something, fix the roof while the sun shines, so they say, because at the moment, of course, the HCA has quite a large budget, which I'm sure will be squeezed in the future. So we're doing everything we can to work with them to build affordable housing.
Now, we're in the Seed Centre here in St Paul's, and just behind us is loads of social housing development going on. Is that typical? Because, I mean, I've noticed also that some of the big commercial house builders have left partially finished housing projects.
They have. You know, we hear reports of building sites being left sort of half finished. What's actually happened in recent years has been that most social housing has been built under what are called Section 106 agreements, and that means that where a private developer builds new housing, a proportion of that has to be affordable, has to be social housing. But now, of course, the house builders, a lot of them are essentially bust, you know, and a lot, and the ones that are surviving are walking off sites and not building. So we can't rely on the private builders to build affordable housing anymore. This is why more grant funding, more public subsidy has to come in.
Well, let's just hope that money's available. Finally, the Scottish Parliament has just talked about stopping the right to buy. Do you think that's a good idea? Is that generally good?
The National Housing Federation has called for a suspension of the right to buy in certain circumstances, especially perhaps in rural areas where there are shortages of housing supply. The real issue, actually, yes, housing's right to buy has reduced the amount of social housing stock. The real problem has been the fact that when that stock was bought, moved into the private sector, there wasn't the funding available to replace it. So it's a supply story. So the right to buy is just part of the jigsaw, which means we just have not been building enough social housing.
Is there any prospects for that in the future, do you think?
Prospects for building enough social housing, you mean? Well, we hope so. That's our job, Housing Association's job, to build social housing. You know, we're trying to find creative ways together with the HCA to make sure that we can keep building in the current economic climate. In fact, the National Housing Federation has said to the government, if you want to stimulate the economy by investing in public services, then housing is the ideal place to do it.
That was Simon Nunn from the National Housing Federation there, based in the Seed Centre in St Paul's. Bristol City Council is one of the largest providers of social housing in this part of the world, and some of the council tenants say the city councillors and council officers limit membership of tenant groups because they don't want to answer some difficult questions. Anyway, I went along to one of the tenant resource centres.
I've been a member of the various tenants groups in Bedminster and Ashton, sat on many city-wide discussions about Bristol City housing, and this is to sort of emphasise what's happened over the last 10 years with Bristol City Council and their housing agenda.
So how long have you actually been a council tenant?
On and off, nearly all my life. Yeah. Since I was born in a council house, bred and raised on one, and ended up, for my dismay, in a high-rise block for elderly people dwellings, for elderly people. A block was reserved for elderly people at Ashton.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can you tell us how you've seen things change? And I mean, there's a lot of people now who are council tenants who feel that the council aren't really doing their job. So, I mean, where did this start? When did this first start happening?
I think about 10 years ago, they wanted to get rid of the estate offices and local labour for repairs and maintenance of their stock.
So there's many people around now that have never seen that. So can you describe how things used to be?
Things used to be, you had a little local office around various estates, and it just serviced about 500 tenancies, and you had a carpenter, a plumber, electrician, what have you, and a foreman, and you could pay your bills there, and the rent man came to your door and all the rest of it. And the rent man used to come, take your money at the door, anything wrong, he would write it down, gardens unkempt, and stuff like this. Was taken care of locally. And if you wanted something done on the house, you went round, saw the foreman, by the way, my tap's dripping, the door's falling off, fine. And we sent a carpenter up, this afternoon, 2 o'clock? Fine. It used to work, because it was all local labour, local people, it worked in the area, people knew them, they were friendly, and jobs were done. And the council stock was kept in very good repair. Since then, however, they've got rid of most of their own labour. They've devolved it into Bristol, what do they call them?
Not the direct labour service.
Direct labour services, that's DLO, that's right, the DLO. And now, a few years ago, they took on Waits and Rock, private companies, to do capital repairs on their blocks. And they really lost control of the way to spend money. They just got Waits and Rock to say, right, we'll look after North, we'll look after South, give us the money and we'll do a couple of repairs. Tenants were left out of the picture. And as long as the housing department get their revenue for their stock and somebody else can deliver the services, they just want to sit there and let it stagnate.
So how have you seen the condition of the housing stock change over the years?
There has been some improvements. They have managed to get rid of some of the ghetto areas and clean them up. But they only provide to the minimum housing standards. What they have to do, they do. And if a tenant has a complaint about damp walls or have you, they say, oh, that's condensation, keep your windows open. And this is prevalent in high-rise blocks throughout the city. Some of the blocks have been cladded through regeneration grants and all the rest of it, but most of the blocks are uncladded. And it's damp penetration into the walls. Surveyor comes along and says, oh, excuse me, madam, but if you keep your windows open at night, condensation won't happen. It's caused by the tenant. The council will not take responsibility for the fabric of the building. I'm trying to get a group to get all the high-rise blocks cladded, but it's going to be a hard, hard job. Huckley, for example, some of the old PRCs, that's the pre-reinforced concrete houses, that had damp problems, have got money through some form or other to have them properly cladded and airtight and all the rest of it. When it comes to high-rise blocks, they seem to walk away and leave it. And it's my opinion that the tenants in the high-rise blocks, it's about over 3,000 in Bristol, quite a large proportion. They are going to find the council will leave them high and dry, and if they can get rid of them to a private or an association, what you want to call it, then so be it.
Because I know in lots of parts of the country, tenants have been balloted, and there's been elections or a referendum in a way, over whether maybe a housing association or some other body should actually take all the housing stock off the council.
We had an option appraisal which was loaded for the council about 5 years ago, and ended up with a handful of people, about 100, agreeing to stay with the council. It was not a democratic vote. And I'll state this with the fear of my throat being cut, but Bristol City Council engineered the whole exercise in such a way that they kept their jobs and their pensions, to the really to the disrespect of council tenants.
But hang on a minute, I mean, that's a big allegation to make. I mean, surely it's, if there's an election or a referendum over whether the housing stock should go to someone else, I mean, people just vote and simply that's the end of it. You can't really fix a vote like that.
You can't fix a vote, but if you have a conglomerate of people, say 40 people in Bristol attending all the different meetings, and they find if they can say yes, 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 and have nice little cushy positions of power, volunteer power. We have a thing called the Housing Management Board, which is created fictitiously. Then they're quite happy. And I've never known a situation where a tenant who wants to revolt against something happening, which is detrimental to the tenants, being accepted as of proper volunteer. And I find it's appalling.
And so what you're saying is that the representatives of the tenants on these various committees and things don't actually truly represent the views of tenants?
I don't think they do represent, because the people that do represent the views of the tenants get railroaded out. They find ways of barring them from meetings. Oh, we have a meeting here today. It's called STOP, Service to Older People. But that's only for sheltered housing, who pay all these fees to be looked after by a remote warden who never lived there. Anyway, another story. I live in an elderly people's block, but I cannot go to that stop meeting because I don't qualify, because I'm not a sheltered tenant. And he's got, the council draw up lines, and if you don't fit in that slot, you can't go.
Well, they've got to draw their lines somewhere, though, haven't they?
They have, but old people are old people. Where they live, they can live in houses, flats, masonettes. But if they're not in the sheltered scheme, they're excluded from stop negotiations. And I find this appalling.
Well, one of the main things to sort of help in situations like you're describing is that there needs to be a robust system for complaints. So when things do go wrong, that there is somebody that people have confidence in who's in a senior management position at the council that can then intervene and sort things out.
Okay, we have various new council service points, customer service points, they call them. They've done away with the area offices. And when you had an area manager, if there was a problem, he could step in, sort the problem out before it blew to something big. Now they've centralised. Before it gets to the top three people on the council housing ladder, you can go to tenants participation unit, which is a quango for officers to help tenants with their problems. It doesn't work. The Tenants Resource Centre here in Redcliffe Hill is manned by volunteers who do try to help tenants, but you can only help so far because the complaints department, again, are run over the telephone and email and all the rest of it. A lot of people like face-to-face contact, to look them in the eye and say, you are lying. We want this done. Promises.
I mean, isn't that one of the reasons why that they don't want to have this face-to-face contact? It's because sometimes tenants can be angry and abusive.
I think tenants, I know lots of them, most of them are quite nice people. They get angry and abusive because they're not being listened to. And the council must listen to what they're trying to say. For example, they're going to sell a lot of garage sites off because the council let them deteriorate so as they had to be sold off. They're irreparable. And tenants are angry. They let areas get like a slum deliberately so as they can say, right, we can't use this anymore. Sell it to the housing association. It's gone on all over the city, probably all over the country.
That's Jim White there, who's a council tenant and a long-time Bristol tenants' rights campaigner. So as caretakers are moved out of blocks, then there's less support from social landlords. Where does this leave the tenants who can barely pay the rent? Well, I went down to Stokes Croft last week to have a look at one of the city's most interesting initiatives to at least attempt to help those hit by the credit crunch. It's the Bristol Free Shop, where nothing is on sale and everything is free.
This is the Bristol Free Shop. The whole ground floor is going to be devoted to free goods. First of all, this helps people on low and zero incomes. And also it gets away from the idea of having to buy everything in this society so that we can move towards a no money economy. Obviously, you won't be able to do it right away, but it shows you what can be done and how much stuff can be recycled in this throwaway society.
Now, many of the people who are actually restoring this place are themselves squatters. What's the connection between the free shop and the squatting movement in the city?
Well, Bristol Housing Action Movement has opened this up as an initiative, and this idea is to help squatters partly through the free shop and also through advertising the Bristol Housing Action Movement.
But, I mean, a free shop sounds like a nice idea, but surely you're just going to be inundated with loads of people who are just going to take all your stuff and you're going to be left with nothing.
Well, fortunately, we have a almost unlimited supply of items, partly because there's a whole group of people going around recycling things. And also, there is just such a sheer amount of waste in Bristol, particularly. It's a wealthy city. The other encouraging thing is that people simply come and take what they need, so they're not going out totally laden. Although last week, people did try and get as much into their hands as possible, but there's a physical limit to what people can take. So they simply can't. It becomes a disutility after a while, a mountain of goods rather than a utility. So there are practical limits to the problem.
And also, Stokes Croft is a street drinking area, isn't it? I mean, are you worried that you're just going to end up with this place becoming a drinking den?
Well, there's a no drink, no drugs policy. Plus, we're only open 2 to 5 on a Thursday. We may open on Thursday morning. So we hope to limit it just by various conventions that we'll put into force. And, you know, there's plenty of other places on a sunny day to go and get completely blutered if you want to. You know, why do it in a dark shop?
The Bristol Free Shop is a community recycling project. The idea is just that we might have already made all the stuff we need in the world once, like, quite a few times over. So we can stop making plastic bowls now. We've got enough. We just need to sort them around a bit. Just bring it in on a Thursday. 35 Stokes Croft from 2 o'clock on a Thursday.
That was Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action at the Stokes Croft shop, and Laura, who works on the shop. So anyway, I thought I'd ask some of the punters actually in the shop what they thought about it too.
I'm Kevin. Oh, I think the free shop's great. There was a free shop at Carboot Circus down at Art Space Life Space just before Christmas.
Okay. Where's that, with people that don't know?
Sort of in where the old Bridewell police station is, the old fire station there, and there was like a 3-day Christmas market. And I think it was Alex, somebody did a free shop there, and we had a bit of a sort of recycling shop, and it was just really good fun, and I thought, yeah, bring more of this, yeah.
Hello, I'm Sylvie. And yeah, it's great, it's brilliant. It's about time, really, that there's a proper free shop coming to Stokes Croft. Because, yeah, the whole free cycling, I think, why I find it really good is because the free cycling on the internet has gone too big and too chaotic, and it's become pointless. And there's time for this local free cycling, free shop thing. And it's
so for people that haven't heard about free cycling, what is free cycling?
Well, there's a community on the internet which is called Free Cycle, and you can join the group and then you put on things that you want to get rid of. Other people can read your advert, they contact you, and they, if they're the only person, they'll have it, and if they're 1 out of 300, you have to choose which one to give your thing to.
Okay, so what have you actually got here today? What have you found, anything useful?
Oh no, I came to bring some stuff. I brought some a garden hose, which made a disaster in our flat the other day.
It works. No, the garden hose works. It's just not suitable for a flat. It's suitable for a garden. It's got a few little leaks in it. But yeah, if you've got a garden, there's a garden hose here. But yeah, not good for us in our little flat, because we've got a roof, a garden on the roof. So we needed some way of watering it up there. Somebody gave us that one. We can't use it, so brought it here. So yeah, it's ideal for that. And the stuff you find on the street, you know, you're just walking towards here and you find some pastry cutters and you think, well, somebody might like those, they're just going to get dumped, or
they'll probably get put into landfill or something.
Landfill, or yeah, or just ends up on the side of the road and scattered all over the place, you know.
Yeah, I found a big black bin line of teddy bears last Sunday, because Monday is bin day, and it was just heartbreaking, all these teddy bears, and someone had taken them out to put on the lamppost and on the fences. And half an hour later, they were back in the bin bags again. So in the end, I said, okay, I'll go and salvage them, and I brought them here.
Well, it's nice to have somewhere which isn't just on the internet to do this stuff. Yeah. What sort of things, you know, can you just describe what's here? What kind of things are available here?
Well, there's clothes, plenty of clothes. I've noticed it's probably quite good if you've got a little young baby and you're a bit short of money, because there seems to be quite a lot of baby stuff. The hose, shoes.
This hose is going to go, isn't it, straight away, even though it's got a few holes in it.
Yeah, well, I think it's just got one hole in it, and it's got some weird tap adapter that we couldn't figure out how to work. The shoes, none in my size, but I am looking for a pair of sort of summer shoes, so I'll pop by later. Pots and pans I haven't really looked at yet. We got so much stuff anyway, because we're kind of slightly, well, Sylvie's sometimes called Queen of the Womble, so she sort of collects stuff anyway. So you were quite happy to have got some stuff out of the house, which we've been meaning to go to free cycling and stuff like that. So, but I will pop in and have a look around. Those shoes I'm after, yeah.
So it's not just a place to come and get things for free. It's also, if you've got something, it's a bit like maybe taking stuff to a charity shop or something.
Yeah, and usually, because I got fed up with the internet thing, I usually put stuff on the fence or on top of the bin. But it just goes to Hannah, who has a little stall outside the Magpies, and she sells it again, which is kind of opposed to my thing, because I want the things to go for free, and I want people to receive it and then maybe pass them on for free as well again.
And do you think maybe with the financial situation that we're in a kind of boom industry of free cycling?
Could be, yeah. There used to be a recession calf here years ago, so I remember that, and there was a little cafe on Newfoundland Street. I can't remember a free shop there, but I think you could get stuff from the cafe. You know, people would bring stuff. And I think, if you've got young kids and sort of clothes for kids, it's probably really quite important and really helpful, because, they cost money and kids get through clothes really quickly.
That was Kevin and Sylvie there, who were bringing some items down to donate to the Bristol Free Shop in Stokes Croft and explaining why they think it's such a good idea. And the shop is open from 2 to 5 every Thursday afternoon on the west side at the bottom of Stokes Croft, just past the ICI paint shop, if you're heading out of the city centre. Anyway, I'm joined now by Martin Summers again. Now, we've got two slightly different issues there: council tenants finding the state of their flats and houses deteriorating, and some of Bristol's more sorted squatters and their friends putting in place a new version, I suppose, of the free market. That's what they would say anyway. So, I mean, how do you see the situation developing with housing, as the credit crunch bites?
Hang on a second,
Martin.
Sorry. Housing is central to our problems. And as some of the contributors already mentioned, the decision to sell off council housing in the 1980s was the root of many of the problems that we're facing now. Council housing was developed as a policy after the war in Britain in order to stabilise the macro economy. So instead of having a situation where, as the economy begins to pick up and starts to grow, house prices rise, then you have to, it creates inflationary pressure and you have to put the brakes on, so the economy never gets really going. The whole point of building council houses was to give people a stability about their housing, which allowed the economy to grow faster without big increases in house prices. But of course, the policy from the 80s onwards has been to encourage increases in house prices as a way of giving those who own property a free lunch. So whether you get a low level free lunch because you're a lower middle class person who buys your house, or you get a big free lunch like the Duke of Westminster, who's the biggest landowner in Britain, he owns most of central London. Now if you're a homeowner listening to this, you will be aware that when the housing bubble was expanding, you were making money, you were being given free money by society. Far more free money, in actual fact, than many people receive as benefits. But of course, we don't call this benefits. This is middle class asset inflation. But of course, the real winners are the big property owners, who were worth billions to begin with and are worth billions more by the end of a year in which house prices have risen by, say, 30%. All of which is a great money spinner for those who are on the gravy train. But unfortunately, at least one third and probably half of the population are not on that gravy train. They pay taxes, they're part of the system, but they don't get subsidised, or they don't get subsidised to the same extent.
So do you think this
creates great imbalances in the efficiency of running the economy? It's not only unfair, it's inefficient.
So do you think that this credit crunch is going to really exacerbate class divisions?
Well, quite obviously it is. Some people are going to benefit, some, you know, hedge fund people are benefiting from the market going up or down. Some people are going to lose a little bit. Some people are going to lose a lot. But the usual, the real losers are, as always, going to be the people at the bottom of the pile.
So, in a nutshell then, what can we do to build a safe and secure housing policy for the future?
Well, I think everybody's been hinting at the obvious, which is we've got to build affordable housing. Yeah? If you're going to have an unequal pay structure, which for all kinds of efficiency reasons we maybe do want, then you've got to recognise that probably half the population are never going to have enough income to buy decent housing. And therefore, you have to make an executive decision, we're going to provide decent housing. And that's not just fair, as I say, it's also efficient. It means that you can run the economy at a faster rate without creating inflationary pressure. We've created an inflation nightmare in this country around house prices, and it's just unfair and inefficient. But of course, some vested interests, estate agents, landowners, making a big killing out of this.
Right, Martin, thanks very much, and we'll be hearing more from you next week on our where our theme is transport. Now, on to Quentin Masseron, who's got a piece, I believe, this week on boss napping in France.
Hi, Tony, and hi, everybody. Yeah, an old phenomenon has reappeared in France the last 3 months, and it's called boss napping. Indeed, with the economic crisis, a lot of workers have been fired and factories have been closed. That's the reason why French workers have taken several bosses captive in the past 2 months to demand better redundancy deals. Chief executives at truck company Caterpillar, office supplier 3M, Japanese technology giants Sony, and parts manufacturer Kleber Michelin have been successfully boss-napped, which means the workers have got what they wanted. For example, redundancy pay has been increased and factories have been saved. Let's hear an extract from Radio France International.
In recent weeks, angry employees of at least three companies have held their bosses hostage and refused to allow them to return home from their offices until the workers' demands are met. The bosses' ordeals have not usually lasted more than 48 hours, and they have been released unharmed, emotionally traumatized, but physically okay. In most cases, the workers have been successful in getting what they want. The phenomenon has shocked many outside France, but caused surprisingly little fuss here. And up to half of French people in a recent poll said workers were justified in their acts. There's been a muddled response from politicians on left and right until Tuesday, when President Nicolas Sarkozy said the practice had to stop. I discussed it with Olivier Ferrand, who is with the progressive think tank Terra Nova.
There is indeed a sort of civil unrest, however gentle at the moment. Why is that? First of all, it's a feeling of injustice among the French citizens. You know, they are being made redundant on a massive scale, and they have the feeling that some of the big boss, some of them, still want to retain their hyper remunerations even in the middle of the crisis. And there is a second feeling, which is that the government is autistic. They don't negotiate. And the signals the government is sending is always negative vis-a-vis the middle class and the overall public. For instance, the stimulus package does not include any support for the purchasing power of the middle class, and especially the poorest people of our society. This is a unique case in all the Western world where there is a refusal by the government to help those who are the victims of the crisis. So that's really a feeling of the government being autistic. So altogether, we have a public opinion in France which is very frustrated, and that's why only there was a poll that said that only 7% of the French population was condemning the this boss snapping, that the proof that there is a very widespread feeling of frustration. From the left wing, this ambivalence is quite it was quite understandable. Actually, they they feel they share the feeling of frustration of the population. On the right wing, the problem is really the lingering number of scandals that day after day make the front page of the newspapers about the bosses of major companies abusing the positions to retain their privileges in the middle of the crisis. So on both sides, the answer is difficult. But let me add one thing: is I suppose from the outside, from outside France, it must be quite astonishing, and you would tend to think that it's a pre-revolutionary situation that we have in France. It's not the case. This unrest remains at the moment very gentle, and this bus snapping has nothing to do with full-fledged abduction or people wanted to have the heads of the big bosses on a spike. That's no such thing. It's more a media strategy. If you want to attract the attention of the media at the moment and you're in a company that is shutting down, you need to do something rather extreme. We lack social dialogue in France.
That was Angela Diffley, journalist for Radio France International. French President Nicolas Sarkozy earlier this month said blockading company bosses in their offices was illegal and that he would not allow, I quote, matters to go on like that. No charges have so far been brought, though, against these employees who have detained their bosses. In each case, the managers were released unarmed, and most of them agreed new negotiations. The fact that this method brings good results could give ideas to other countries, but both sacked workers and the managers can wonder, after boss snapping, what could be next.
Lovely, thanks very much. That was fascinating. Shows us just a different approach across the channel. Thanks very much, Quentin. Now it's time to hand over to Colin Power and Carl Saxon, who, as laymen here in Bristol, have been doing a bit of practical exploration of the British court system.
Hello and welcome to another short episode of The Legal Minefield, brought to you by Colin Power
and Carl Saxon.
That's right. Today we'll be looking at the theory of the person and what actually is a person. Actually quite interesting. I was sort of browsing the internet a few months back now, actually, and I came across an interesting documentary. I don't know, have you seen this, Carl? Rob Menard, Bursting Bubbles?
Bursting Bubbles, excellent introductory documentary into this subject. Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you do get a chance, do check out some Rob Menard Bursting Bubbles of Government Deception on the internet. That's the plug over. But so based on that, basically, we started, you sort of started talking about something called the person there and the difference between a natural person and an artificial person. In fact, he sort of says that, you know, it's not that we are people, it's that we have people. So basically, I got myself a copy of Black's Law and I sort of looked into it. And yeah, there it was, two separate definitions. One was like an artificial person and one was a natural person. So natural persons are such as formed by nature, as distinguished from artificial persons or corporations. That's on Black's Law 2. And artificial persons, an entity such as a corporation, created by law and given certain legal rights and duties of a human being. And that's Black's Law 8. So I sort of got a bit confused about that because, you know, I thought, well, I thought a person was just a human being. I didn't realise there was all different types of people out there. What about you?
No, I had absolutely no idea at all until I saw Bursting Bubbles by Rob Menard.
That's it. So we wrote a couple of letters, didn't we?
We wrote quite a lot of letters.
We did. Quite a lot of letters, yeah. A couple of them we wrote to the Attorney General, the Justice Office, the Ministry of Justice, and sort of constitutional offices and various people. And I'd just like to read you maybe an excerpt from one of the letters that we actually sent. Around about in February time, actually. With regard to my understanding, could you please clarify for me the precise and legal factual definition of a person when used in statutory instrument, whereby when we defined the persons, persons are divided by law into natural and artificial. Natural persons are such that as the God of nature formed us. Artificial are such as the created and devised by human laws for the purpose of society and governments, which are called corporations or bodies politic. So further to this, it is my understanding that when a statute law refers to someone, it is to be understood in terms of a person with regard to the presumed definition of the person, i.e. an artificial person. So Then basically, sort of asked her to get back to us within 14 days or so, and they did actually get back to us, didn't they? And what did they say?
Well, they were as helpful as the government normally is. They said, "Dear Mr. So-and-so, thank you for your letter of 5th of April to the Attorney General. I have been asked to reply. The Attorney General is the principal legal advisor to the government and, as such, is unable to offer legal advice to individuals. You may perhaps wish to consult a solicitor for advice on the definition that you seek. Yours sincerely."
So the Attorney General was unable to help there. So so then we went to the Justice Office and we sent the same letter off there, and basically they got back to us a little bit more helpful this time, I felt.
"Dear Sir, I acknowledge receipt of your letter for the 5th of February. In answer to your query, I suggest that you look at the Interpretations Act of 1978 on the Statute Law Database. Yours faithfully."
So very faithfully there. So basically there we were, sort of browsing around the internet. I thought, oh, good. So I looked it up, and there it was in the Interpretations Act 1978. Person includes a body of persons, corporate or unincorporated. And that means that all statutes are thus, whenever you see the word person in a statute, unless it specifically says otherwise, it is actually a body of persons, corporate or unincorporated. So the definition of person, so far as it includes bodies corporate, applies to any provision of an act, whenever passed, relating to an offence punishable on indictment or on summary conviction. Now, summary convictions, I think what we're all sort of dealing with now anyway in the courts, isn't it? Because we don't have an innocent plea anymore, generally.
No, we don't. We have the guilty or not guilty.
So that means summary conviction is actually what we're dealing with in our court system. If anyone has ever noticed that, I don't know that we don't actually have an innocent plea. But that's another... We'll get into that maybe in another series, anyway.
Yeah, that's a whole
that's a whole... Subject. There's a whole different kind of worms. So anyway, I did write a letter back to her, yeah, basically, and... So I said, well, okay, so, you know, I've noticed that, you know, in the Interpretations Act, it also says that all these statute laws are public acts and to be judicially noted as such, yeah, unless the contrary is expressly provided. Now, basically, if you look into your Black's Law again, you've got public act, so that's a public law, the body of law dealing with the relationship between private individuals and the government. So it's a relationship thing going on here. Relationship is the nature of the association between two or more people, especially the legally recognised association that makes a difference in the person's legal rights and duties of care. So basically, this association does affect our lawful standing. Society is an association, again, or company of persons united by mutual consent. And remember, mutual means belonging to two parties, and consent is an agreement given up voluntarily by a competent person. So everything is actually dealt with it by consent. So I sent a letter back to her, and just to sort of find out what she had to say on, you know, my discoveries, and here's what she sort of said.
"Dear so-and-so, I acknowledge receipt of your letter of 11th of February 2009. It is not the function of this office to give guidance on statutory interpretation. If you need further information about the meaning of specific phrases, I suggest you use the website www.baili.org, as that may assist you, and that's spelt baili.org. Yours sincerely."
And it's a very useful website. It's sort of got all the laws on there, and so we did a little bit more digging. Now, we did send one last letter off to the Ministry of Justice, same letter once again, and they sort of got back to us, once again quite helpful.
"Dear Mr. So-and-so, thank you for your letter of the 5th of February to Arena Collins Rice, to which I have been asked to reply. Whilst I'm not able to provide you with legal advice, I would be happy to explain the definition of the word person in statutory instruments as per your request. By virtue of Sections 5 and 23 of the Schedule 1 to the Interpretation Act 1978, the person, when used either in an Act of Parliament or in statutory instrument, includes a body of persons corporate or unincorporated. The effect is that a reference to a person will cover both a natural person, an individual, and a legal person. I hope this satisfies your query."
Now, some people might be a little bit disheartened by that thing, because it sort of seemed to say that, you know, it was legal persons and sort of natural persons. But when we started to look a little bit more deeply into the man's sentiments, he actually said effect. The effect is that it will cover. So when we looked at the word cover, it's actually cover is an agreement. It's like an insurance policy. It's an agreement, once again. An effect, the result that an instrument between parties will produce on their relative rights. Then we had things like, you know, individual. existing as an indivisible unit. Now, basically, as a natural person, a human being, we are endowed with something called absolute rights, a right that belongs to every human being, a natural right. It's also known as an unalienable right, a right that cannot be transferred or surrendered, especially a natural right. And a natural right is a right that is conceived as part of natural law and is therefore thought to exist independently of rights created by government or society. Now, just as a final note, I did actually sort of pose this question. I did actually go down to a civil liberties meeting not so long ago, and I did actually pose the question as to about 50 civil liberties campaigners if they actually knew the difference between a civil liberty and an unalienable human right, and none of them did. So one of the things I would sort of seriously recommend is that we start to look into some of these definitions so that we can start to understand how it is that the law actually operates. Lastly, remember, everything is done through relationship. So the nature of the association between two or more people, a legally recognised association that makes a difference to the participants' legal rights and duties of care. And remember that a joinder is the uniting of parties or claims in a single lawsuit. So there you go. We're going to be talking more about that next week when we talk about contracts and how they're formed and things like that. But for now, that's all from the Legal Minefield. Do check out the facts. And by the way, remember, we're just laymen. There's no legal advice here. Just go and check out the facts for yourself.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Carl. And one thing I would just add to that is that there's a very interesting film about the legal status of corporations called The Corporation, which is quite long. It's about 2.5 hours long, but it's well worth watching. Well, it's nearly 6 o'clock, and that's all we have time for this week. Join us on Friday Drive Time, this and every Friday, 5 till 6, for the next few weeks here on BCFM, where we'll be doing our level best to keep a pace of the latest developments in Bristol, Britain and around the world. Next week, we take a look at transport in Bristol. After the Second World War, with trains, trams and trolley buses, Bristol had one of the most efficient public transport networks in the country. So what happened? We'll be taking a look at that next week. Thanks to our reporter Quentin Masseron. Economic analysis and review of this week's other news was by Martin Summers. Legal Minefield reporters were Colin Power and Carl Saxon. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a sunny weekend. Get out early tomorrow to catch the best of the weather. And remember, we have 60 million people roughly in Britain and about 60 million acres. So whilst it might feel sometimes that there's not enough resources to go round, that's only because soulless corporations and the super rich have taken far more than their share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out properly, and with modern technology we can all live quite happily together. Join us for another Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the bankers get you down.
Listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.